This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
What if China could drop a nuclear weapon anywhere on Earth on a maneuverable missile too fast for missile defense systems to stop? Well, it appears this is the game-changing reality the world is facing after a couple of top-secret weapons tests that completely blindsided American intelligence. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was on Saturday that the Financial Times first broke this news, saying that over the summer, China tested a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile, and for this test, the missile fully circled the globe before finally changing course and then speeding toward its target at about five times the speed of sound. And then it apparently hit within about 25 miles of that target. So this demonstrated an advanced weapons capability that apparently, as you said, caught U.S. intelligence off guard. This was that was the news on Saturday, October 16th, but then on Wednesday the 20th, The Times published a follow-up article saying that China actually tested two of these hypersonic weapons over the summer, one in July and one in August. So at first we thought it was just one, but now we know the testing is even further advanced than we initially thought there. And it shows that China is gaining just some major ground in the race to develop a new generation of weapons. And these weapons are truly remarkable. They use what's called a fractional orbital bombardment system to propel hypersonic glide vehicles around the Earth before releasing a nuclear-capable missile toward its target. So for one of the missiles that was tested, it was a full revolution around the planet, which is a first as far as we know. And that means that China has hit a major milestone with this, you know, just incredibly sophisticated, low-Earth orbiting nuclear-capable missile. These hypersonic missiles are the ones that we speak about so often for having just extraordinary range, extraordinary speed, and maneuverability, which all combined together, that means that they pose problems, not just for U.S. missile defense systems, but even for the early warning systems, just to know where a missile's coming from, whether or not it's nuclear armed. All of that apparently is in question because of these. And that's partly because in low Earth orbit, they could strike the U.S. from directions that we don't monitor. As part of the kind of cool down there, you know, toward the end of the Cold War, some systems were put into place so that Russia and the U.S. knew that launches would generally be coming from the North Pole. But with this, China could launch from the South Pole, and that's essentially exploiting blind spots that we intentionally have for deterrence purposes. But now those deterrents are considerably weakened by all of this. Admiral Charles Richard, the head of Strategic Command who oversees America's nuclear forces, he spoke about this week, and he called it a, quote, breathtaking expansion of Chinese power. And then he said it means China could now, quote, execute any possible nuclear employment strategy. So that's just a chilling assessment there, and I think it shows just how far the Chinese military has come with its nuclear capabilities in recent years.
Now, we've talked about how China steals United States technology. This seems to have been created, designed, implemented, executed in China, no?
Yes, from what we can tell, this is indigenous, but a lot of the foundational technology is still almost certainly, you know, lifted from what they've sure. seen America do and what's been shown to be tried and true.
But the groundbreaking nature of this, it really does exceed any of the U.S. capabilities. There were even some who said that they didn't realize that missiles could even do that until they saw this this test.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, it's I think because of those deterrent treaties that the U.S. signed with the Soviet Union, it's going into a lot of territory that we intentionally avoided just to try to minimize nuclear escalation.
This really is about as strong of an indicator of just how aggressive China's war-making capability and its intentions are anything that we've seen out of China, isn't it?
I think it really is, yes. Like the admiral said there, it shows a breathtaking expansion mm-hmm. of Chinese power. So it really is a milestone.
So China is making advancements in a number of areas, and this is, I guess, another dimension to the war-making potential of space technologies and this type of thing. And China is actually making a lot of advancements in that realm as well.
They are. Actually, just this week, just the day after this news broke from the Financial Times, there was a statement by General David Thompson. He's the second in command of the U.S. Space Force. That's the newest branch of the U.S. military. It was just created 3 years ago under the Trump administration. But General Thompson said that China keeps on accelerating its rollout of all these critical new technologies. Last week they launched their first crew into space to set up base in their new space station, the Tiangong, or the Heavenly Palace. That was a major advancement for China with all kinds of military implications. And then China is also forging ahead with its development of satellite attacking technologies. He's sounding the alarm about that quite a lot. So General Thompson says if current trends persist, the Chinese will very soon overtake the U.S. and become the most dominant force in space. So that's, we've talked many times about how that's a realm that's just of critical importance to the U.S. military, because we rely on our satellites in orbit for all kinds of communications and targeting and reconnaissance systems. And America has been the dominant space player since the 1960s when we overtook the Soviets. But now China is chipping away at that edge and just rapidly expanding its power. And I think when you put that up next to this missile milestone that China is also now crossing with its hypersonic tests, it shows just how quickly China is becoming an alarmingly powerful military force.
The Biden administration responded by not confirming or denying that the Chinese missile test took place. You look at the response among the leaders in the United States, and it just seems like there's a certain naivety there and an unwillingness to acknowledge the severity of the threat that's coming from China. In a lot of ways, headlines like these, we've heard some of the somewhat routine headlines coming out of Russia in terms of the way that they've been developing hypersonic technology. And I think most Americans just don't seem particularly concerned about this. But when you look at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, aside from the fact that just there are people in other nations that really would like to take the United States down, and this is hard evidence of just how far they're willing to go. But you look at Bible prophecy and you see that nuclear warfare really is something that we should be very concerned about.
Yes, that's exactly right. These hypersonic missiles that America and other powers can't defend against, and also this news about China's increasing space power, which would just further complicate any kind of defenses against Chinese nuclear weapons, this all exposes just how fragile the global peace really is. It shows us that the unthinkable is becoming more and more likely by the day. And if you look at Bible prophecy, as you said, there are several passages that talk about a war that will soon break out. And we know from some of the details there that it will be a nuclear war. Matthew 24 tells us that this future war will be so destructive, it'll have the potential to obliterate all human life from the planet. So, from that detail, we know that this is talking about a nuclear war that ends up spawning nuclear winter. So I think when we see China testing these unstoppable nuclear-capable missiles, that shows us how soon this future war could happen. And it, I think it could be easy to become kind of discouraged about that. But those same prophecies that talk about this coming nuclear war also say mankind will not be entirely destroyed by that conflict. The war will actually be interrupted by the most exciting event in world history. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written a booklet on this subject. It's called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. And so he spends a lot of time explaining what the Bible tells us about this devastating war. But he also discusses that good news about the divine interruption and everything that follows it. So I just hope that any listeners that don't have a copy of Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door will go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy there.
Yeah, it's definitely important to put events like this in that broader context and to realize that we really are seeing events that are leading step by step to that that ultimate prophetic fulfillment, Jesus Christ's return. At the same time, you have to pay close attention when things like this happen, as asleep as the United States may be when it comes to confronting this kind of technology. I've just been thinking about how much Europe must be looking at this and reacting very with a lot of alarm, and just realizing we've been talking quite a bit about just how many factors there are that are pushing Europe to recognize the importance of unifying militarily, pulling together and being able to confront and address some of the rising threats. And the threat from China is massive, and it's growing, and this technology really does demonstrate that in a powerful way. I think it really is going to be yet one more factor that that catalyzes that European unification that we've been talking about. We'll have to see what the response is over there, but you just have to believe that they're paying very close attention to the development of these technologies in that Asian giant. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. While we were taping this program last week, news dropped of the murder of a British MP in a knife attack. Now, all the details of the story are out, and nobody in Britain seems to want to talk about the most important detail. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so we now know that the murder was carried out by a 25-year-old of Somali descent named Ali Harabi Ali. And you know, he went into this frenzied attack, stabbing this MP, Sir David Ames, multiple times until he died. And it has now been declared a terrorist incident. The police put out a statement. The fatal stabbing in Lady on Seat has tonight been described as a terrorist incident, with the investigation being led by counter-terrorism policing. The early investigation has revealed a potential motivation linked to Islamist extremism. So it looks like this individual in question had become radicalized watching online videos while in lockdown. So we have yet another terrorist attack. And what I find absolutely astonishing is no one wants to talk about that this was an Islamist attack. I mean, if you think about, imagine if a congressman had been killed during the January 6th riots.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, That would be incredibly unlikely. That wasn't the character of the rioters generally that were there, or the protesters. But I mean, imagine that happened. You know, you would get locked. It would be a criminal offense to watch Fox News by now. The response to that would have been incredibly strong. But instead, now here we have an MP equivalent to, say, a congressman stabbed to death, and nobody wants to talk about why. Instead, you know, the parliament is in the process of passing something that they've called David's Law, in memorial for this MP, and what this would do is ban anonymous Twitter accounts.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing whatsoever to do with his murder. There is no evidence that this guy, that the terrorist was even on Twitter, or that he was posting anonymous threats or anonymous attacks or criticisms on MPs. Online abuse against our elected representatives and threats against our elected representatives, maybe that is something that needs dealing with. It has nothing to do with last Friday's attack. We just won't talk about and won't look at the causes here. And it is just astounding.
This has been a familiar story in Britain and in many other nations as well. Just a complete unwillingness to face reality when it comes to the unpleasant facts of the threat from Islamists.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's there's a couple of, I think there's a few reasons why they're doing this. I think, you know, in part, these are hard problems to solve. I mean, this the MI5 is investigating 3,000 potential extremists in the UK. And this terrorist, he wasn't on that list of 3,000. He was on the list of 40,000 potential radicals that the UK government has. So you have 40,000 potential terrorists in your country, and for whatever reason, you refuse to deport them. Maybe they're British citizens like this person, just simply because they were born in the UK. It's a hard problem to deal with, and they don't want to deal with this kind of threatening reality. But what I thought was interesting, just before coming on this show, I was looking back over some of our coverage of radical Islam and the problem of radical Islam. And what I found was really interesting is you can just see this problem present, but just getting worse. You know, you go back to, say, our coverage right after 9/11, and you had an article, The Head of the Snake, talking about how America, after 9/11, was refusing to go after the head of the snake, was refusing to clearly define the problem. We had this kind of vague war on terror instead of really getting to grips with the cause, who was behind it, dealing with it. And then since then, it's just gotten worse. You know, I mean, what we would do, the response after 9/11 was a lot better than where we are today. And I mean, the point that you made in that article is that we just don't have the will to deal with this problem. That, you know, one of the, that you can turn to Leviticus 26 and you can see blessings and cursings that, that God would promise for our nations. And one of the cursings for being disobedient is God said he would break the pride of our power. He would break our will. And we saw that after 9/11, we didn't have the will to deal with the problem. And it's getting worse. We're in a worse position now. We don't even have the will to talk about the problem. And then just, you know, looking back, another article that I came across is one that Mr. McDonald wrote in May 2017, Manchester attack, keep calm and carrying on is not working. And this was about the last major terrorist attack in Britain, where you had that big attack on an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester. And I think there were dozens of people killed. And back then, the response, the big response, was keep calm and carry on. You know, we fight terrorism by ignoring it. We fight terrorism by living a normal life. And so you can almost just track us getting worse at this. After 9/11, it was deal with the problem, but it's defined vaguely. May 2017, it was ignore the problem. And now we're just getting to the point where it's don't even talk about the problem. Let's just pretend that it doesn't exist, and talk about anonymous Twitter accounts.
So how do you view this prophetically speaking? There are passages in prophecy that describe Britain's naivety and its unwillingness to confront threats that seem to speak pretty directly to what we're seeing here.
That's right. I mean, it talks about Britain being like a silly dove, not knowing that it's in danger. I thought Mr. McDonald in his article brought up some really interesting scriptures as well, where he quoted from Isaiah 30, where talking about our people saying to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. He then went on and talked about there being, you know, dumb dogs. Is another passage in Isaiah there, where it says all his watchmen are blind, they are all ignorant, they are dumb dogs. That's in Isaiah 56 and verse 10. And he said, what an apt description of the leadership and mainstream media in Britain and America. And that's exactly what we see. You know, there's a terrorist attack and the dogs don't bark, the watchmen don't see. You know, Mr. Gerald Flurry, he talked about this. Mr. McDonald quotes from him in a Key of David program, and he said, you know, these watchmen, they won't tell you what's really happening, either because they don't know, and even if they do know, they won't tell you the blatant, scary truth. And, you know, the point Mr. McDonald went on is fundamentally, if you really get to the roots of all of these problems that we won't talk about, well, it's sin. It's lawlessness. It's a mass disobedience of God's law. We're not, God is not protecting us. There are things that we are doing wrong that are and foolish decisions that we're making that are directly causing and contributing to this. There are, you know, things that we are doing wrong that have led to this situation where we have 40,000 potential terrorists inside the UK. And then, you know, we are sinning. God is not protecting us. He's allowing these attacks. And by ignoring them, and by pretending they're not happening, well, we don't get to the cause. We don't get to the solution. We don't start taking practical steps that can deal with this. And we, most importantly, we don't start repenting and turning to God. And so really this refusal to talk about this is directly connected to our national destruction. You know, God is having to up the punishments to get our attention. You know, this, he has a plan to get our attention, to bring our nations to repentance. But if we won't even acknowledge that there's a problem, you know, we're falling far before even the very first steps of repentance. We're not making it anywhere close. So, you know, the good news is God does have a plan there, and he's going to keep working with our nations until we do repent. But he's going to have to work a lot harder to get our attention if we just won't even talk about the curses that are coming upon our countries.
Excellent points. God is trying to reach us, and if we're not going to heed, then those curses are going to intensify. We will link to those articles that you mentioned, particularly Brad McDonald's article about the Manchester attack, in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for bringing that to us, Richard. American troops in Syria came under attack on Wednesday. Well, who was responsible, and how did America respond? For answers, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there is a U.S. base that's operating right on the border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, the Al-Tanf base. It's extremely important strategically, and this base came under attack on Wednesday by drones and also missiles. As of right now, the U.S. Defense Department has said that there aren't any injuries or deaths as a result of this attack, but that damage assessment is still ongoing. And what's really important about this is obviously two things: who is the perpetrator. It seems obvious because the weapons of choice were these kamikaze drones and also rockets, that it was probably an Iranian-backed militia operating out of Iraq or Syria, that this border between Iraq and Syria is one that Iran has tried to control for a long, long time. And Iran has a lot of assets, obviously, inside Iraq and Syria. And so it seems to point, all the analyses points to Iran behind this. But why are they attacking this base now? This is the first major attack on the Al-Tanf base. It's one of the places inside Syria that has U.S. troops. Right now, there's about 900 U.S. troops inside Syria. About half of those are more in the northeast of the country with the Kurds and protecting oil fields. And then the rest of them are in this base, which is a very far-flung place, a desolate place, yet it's on a critical roadway that connects Baghdad with Syria. If you're going to go in a direct route as much fast as you can between Baghdad and Damascus, then you're going to travel along this road that's going to take you right through the Al-Tanf region where this U.S. base is set up. And so a lot of commentators, Eli Lake from Bloomberg, Seth Franzman from the Jerusalem Post, and others are looking at this attack from the Iranians as a really initial strike to try and discourage, or let's say encourage, the United States from leaving this base, upping the ante, showing them that they can be attacked. And perhaps as the U.S. has withdrawn from over six bases in Iraq over the past couple of years, perhaps Al-Tanf will be next, even though it's across the border into Syria.
Seems like a pretty solid assumption, given America's behavior through the rest of the region.
Yeah, and it was actually, this base was really critical for trying to encourage Donald Trump for leaving some servicemen inside Syria. Remember, he came and announced in 2019 that we're getting out of Syria. But the generals talked to him and said, bad idea, especially from this base. And this is what General Joseph Fattel, the commander of U.S. Central Command, said back in 2018, just before Trump's decision or announcement. He said this: we don't have a counter-Iranian mission here, meaning Tanf, this location. we have a defeat the Islamic State mission. That's the purpose. But I do recognize that our presence, our developments of partners and relationships down here does have an indirect effect on some malign activities that Iran and their various proxies and surrogates would like to pursue down here. It was a big moment because America is in Syria because of the Islamic State, yet the Islamic State war was winding down. And Vattel basically said, no, we're stationed right here because this is a critical border crossing that would give Iran, that is preventing Iran from having unfettered control from Lebanon to Iranian territory. We need to stay here. And so there weren't really many attacks of note over the past couple of years on TANF. But now that situation is changing, and what they're using for these attacks, their kamikaze drones and other type of drones and rockets. Eli Lake goes on to show that these drones are getting more and more sophisticated. Seth Franzman just wrote a book about the drone warfare in the Middle East, and he basically says that it all changed for Iran back in 2011 when the Iranians shot down a U.S. drone. And then reverse engineered it. This was the famous drone that Obama refused to go and get, you might recall. And so they're using reverse engineered American technology to now attack America in the Middle East, and attacking them at very critical locations. And will the Biden administration pull out from this location? Well, we've seen them pull out from Afghanistan, obviously, and hand over that territory to a terrorist organization, the Taliban. It stands to reason that they could be encouraged to do so here if Americans are increasingly under attack.
How do you see this playing out, given what we understand about prophecy, Brent?
Well, I could see this definitely taking place. I can see in the very short term, I can see the Iranians really encouraging the Iraqis to put pressure, the Iraqi elements to put pressure on the United States to remove themselves from Iraq, from the last remaining, I think, two bases that they have inside Iraq. And this could happen very easily inside this base in Syria as well. We know that this Biden administration's foreign policy in the Middle East is to empower Islamists, empower terrorists, this terrorist state of Iran and its proxies. They used to do so through subtle means such as the nuclear deal. Now they're doing so through removing or handing over billions of dollars of weapons to terrorist organizations such as the Taliban. And so I think the short term we could see that. In the long term, we know that Syria and Lebanon are two countries that are going to fall back out of Iranian control. And the border between these two big alliances in the Middle East in terms of biblical prophecy is the Iraqi-Syria border. And so perhaps in the short term, this is a loss for the United States. Perhaps they will leave. Perhaps Iran will gain power through this area and become stronger. But then in the future, we know eventually that this border between these two powers is going to be the Eastern Syrian battlefield. And so perhaps this is something that Donald Trump works on when he comes back into office, as the Bible prophesies.
Anywhere you'd send people for more information?
To learn about the importance of this LTANF base, they can read an article back from 2019 entitled America is Backing Out.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Brent. Illegal immigration continues to overwhelm America's southern border. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, America just passed an all-time record of the number of immigrants crossing its southern border, with the fiscal year that ended in September 30th. For the 12 months previous to that, 1.7 million illegal aliens crossed into the United States, or at least encountered by Border Patrol agents trying to cross into the United States. I guess you can't count the ones they didn't encounter. But I guess just for context, that's roughly the size of Phoenix, Arizona, which is the fifth biggest city in the nation, that have moved from Latin America across the Mexican border into the United States in one fiscal year. And an all-time high. It seems like previously I keep writing news updates on illegal immigration, saying that more immigrants have come here than there have in 10 years, and then 20 years, and then 21 years. It's like, well, now it actually passed the previous record set in 1986, when 1.69 million illegal immigrants came into America. So we're now officially in uncharted territory where there's never been this many illegal immigrants crossed into the United States ever before. And you'd think now crossing into uncharted territory that the government would want to do something more about this than it's doing, because in 1986 when this happened, I mean the Reagan administration passed some pretty sweeping reforms that tightened up border security, that made it illegal for employers to hire illegal immigrants, and took some drastic action to get that numbers down. But so far, all Joe Biden's really done is threaten to go after Border Patrol agents who treat those trying to cross the border illegally too harshly, and send in the U.S. military to round up some of these immigrants and fly them to cities inside the United States. And so you keep seeing, like I said, report after after report of just like the the White House press secretary admitted that there's illegal immigrants being flown into New York City at nighttime, where they don't have enough room for them on the border. You've probably seen the pictures of how crowded it is. So now they're sending in planes, and instead of sending them back to Mexico City or Guatemala or Honduras, they turn the plane around the other way, and they're sending them to New York and Savannah and Dallas and all these other cities within the United States. And so could really be a pretty intense crisis. Actually, Mark Morgan was the acting commissioner for U.S. Customs and Border Protection for the last year of the Trump administration. And he recently wrote a piece for Hillsdale College where he writes, "In just a few short months, the Biden administration has created a disaster on the southern border of the United States. It did so methodically and by all indications intentionally, undoing every meaningful border security measure that had been in place. I've been in federal law enforcement in various capacities for more than 35 years under six different administrations. And while I've become numb to the spin and misdirection that is commonplace in Washington, I've never seen as blatant a disinformation campaign as this one." And so he's definitely pointing out that this is really systematically done to dismantle all the border protections so this crisis could happen. It's a planned crisis. And then he brings out some statistics as well that said just this year, Border Patrol has arrested 8,000 criminal immigrants, including 46 murderers, 393 sex offenders, and 880 assailants. It's also arrested several members of MS-13, a violent street gang, and two Yemeni nationals in the U.S. terrorist screening database. So he's pointing out that some of these migrants here, it's like at least 8,000 that they know of, are either murderers or rapists or Islamic terrorists or violent drug traffickers that are mixed in with this group being transported. Well, I guess those 8,000 they found, but whatever they didn't find are on those planes being transported to cities across the United States.
Well, Mark Morgan definitely hit the nail on the head when he said that by all indications, the Biden administration is intentional about what it's doing here, and it is intended to hurt the United States. This is more evidence of America under attack.
Right, definitely. I mean, maybe you can try to make the claim that you accidentally let some immigrants slip across the border, but you can't very well make the claim that you accidentally rounded them up, put them on planes, and sent them to New York City. that's kind of deliberate and causing some big problems in the United States. There's also the fact that like a lot of these ones coming from Central America, they're fleeing places that are basically in like Marxist civil wars almost, with these various factions for competing for power and rigged elections. And so a lot of these immigrants could well be Marxist revolutionaries as well, coming in and then voting illegally in our elections, bringing the policies of the countries they're trying to get away from to the country they're going to. And this is all prophesied. I mean, we've covered this before on this program, where about the prophecy in Isaiah 1 and verse 7 in particular. If you read that in the Revised Standard Version, it actually reads, "Your country lies desolate, your cities are burned with fire. In your very presence, aliens devour your land. It is desolate as overthrown by aliens." And so it shows that these people who are burning the cities of end times Israel and throwing the nation. They're not Israelites. They're illegal aliens. Like I said, the King James uses the word stranger. The Revised Standard uses the word alien, but it really means the same thing as someone who's not from this country or this culture coming in and overthrowing the land and burning the cities. And when you you look around America today at just like all the drug problems and the gang violence that's besetting our cities, and how much of that is actually from people who aren't even here legally, but have been have crossed here from Guatemala or Nicaragua or El Salvador, Mexico, even some African and Middle Eastern nations who've worked their way up across the southern border to really cause like pestilence style violence in the United States. I mean, you can definitely see that it sounds a lot like Isaiah 1 and verse 7.
Mm-hmm. It's a terrible curse. It's caused by the curse of bad government, and it's going to lead to a whole lot more curses as well. We appreciate you bringing that to us. Andrew actually has an article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. Illegal border crossings hit all-time high. Go check that out. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a threat from Vladimir Putin playing hardball with Europe using the weapon of energy politics. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Nord Stream 2, the massive pipeline project between Russia and Germany, is ready to go, but it awaits final regulatory approval from Europe. And Vladimir Putin just made very clear that this approval had better be coming. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, as you said, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which runs from Russia under the Baltic Sea and into Germany, it's now completed. So everything's in place for it to start pumping huge amounts of Russian natural gas into Germany. But the problem is Russia does not yet have regulatory approval from Europe to start shipping gas. There are many European policymakers who fear the power that this gives to Vladimir Putin. They worry about how much leverage he'll have over some of them. So there has been plenty of opposition to granting that final approval. But Putin anticipated this. And all the way back in August, he started reducing shipments of gas to Europe through some of his older pipelines, especially the Yamal pipeline that goes from Russia into Belarus and then through Poland and finally into Germany. So Putin has been slowing the flows through the Yamal for months now, and that prevented European nations from being able to store up extra gas in anticipation of the winter. They had just enough to get by for summer, but now winter's very near, gas supplies are dwindling, prices are soaring, and Putin has all the cards. On Tuesday, one of his energy czars, Konstantin Kosachyov, talked about Europe's energy crisis, and he said, quote, "Russia cannot ride to the rescue just to compensate for mistakes that we didn't commit. We're fulfilling all our contracts. Everything on top of that should be a subject for additional voluntary and mutually beneficial agreements." End quote. So he's saying that technically what Russia's doing is legal. They've hired the best lawyers they can find to exploit these loopholes that allow them to legally reduce those shipments. But it's very exploitative what they're doing there. At the Trumpet, you know, we've long been saying that Nord Stream 2 is dangerous because it'll let Russia weaponize its energy. It'll let Russia, you know, punish certain nations by withholding shipments. And here we see that even before Nord Stream 2 is pumping, Russia is already using this energy weaponization tactic. They're making clear that if Europe wants to avoid a miserable and a dangerous winter, then the Europeans have to give Russia something in return. And that is the green light on Nord Stream 2. So basically, all the warnings against Nord Stream that many called kind of alarmist for the last few years, those are all being proven to have been well-founded warnings. It's already playing out in a way that is making the world a colder and a darker place.
This does give Russia a whole lot of power. It also empowers Germany, the other end, the recipient of that energy on the other end of the pipeline.
Yes, it does. Yeah, Germany's power will be boosted by this project, because once the Germans receive Russia's gas, they normally ship a lot of it off to France and other countries in Western Europe. But if Germany had a reason to cut off a certain country from those shipments, it will now be very well positioned to do that. And that basically means that Germany will have more leverage to force various Western European countries to submit to its will, just like Russia will now have a lot more leverage to force Eastern European countries, especially former Soviet nations, to submit to its will. So the Nord Stream pipelines have the potential to make both Russia and Germany considerably more powerful. And then the pipelines, they're also linking Russia and Germany together in a very disturbing way. It shows that these two countries are working together to essentially undermine NATO and America, and in a way that has some really dark and disturbing historic precedents. If you look look back at the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, for example, that pact of cooperation between Russia and Germany helped to create the conditions for the bloodiest war in human history. And Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote in our September 2018 issue that Nord Stream today shows that Russia and Germany are entering into what he called a modern Molotov-Ribbentrop deal. And he called it a signal that either or both are preparing for some kind of imperialistic exploit. That's in an article called Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And that article is all built on Bible prophecy. He bases it all on passages in the books of Jeremiah and Matthew and some others. And he shows how trends underway today, right now, with the Nord Stream pipelines and related developments, they're all leading to a time of unprecedented global conflict.
Well, for more context about the geopolitical significance of this pipeline, read Gerald Fleury's article, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. We'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. And we thank you very much, Jeremiah. While Europe continues to talk incessantly about the need to build a unified European military, Germany is taking concrete steps to make it happen. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, details of a plan emerged yesterday where Germany has gotten together with Finland, the Netherlands, Portugal, and Slovenia to extend an EU military project. So the European Union several years ago set up the system of European battle groups. And these are supposed to be rapid reaction forces. They're 1,500 strong. And the idea is they're sitting there ready to go. So if you have an emergency, they can be on the scene. They've never been used. They were not used in Afghanistan this year. They've never been used in any other crisis. It's just proven too bureaucratic and politically difficult to get them going. So Germany is taking this project and beefing it up. So they're looking at creating battle groups that are bigger, around 5,000 strong. They're looking at giving them more responsibility. So they would include things like air transportation, which is critical if you've got a rapid reaction force. You need to have the transportation to get to where you're going. And then also space and cyber capabilities. They're using a provision in the Lisbon Treaty, or the Treaty of the European Union, that's never been used before to do this. So Article 44 allows a smaller group of willing member states to move forwards when it comes to security and military projects, regardless of what the other states say or think or want. So this allows them to move forwards unhindered. So it's a very interesting proposal. It's or a plan that's being moved forwards with now. You know, instead of having these battle groups with a command structure of 27 different nations and lots of people that you have to talk to, it's just five nations and then a bigger, more capable battle group.
We've been talking about just how much urgency there is in Europe, given America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, the need for a unified European military. But as you said, there's so much bureaucratic red tape. There's so much resistance to this in so many ways when you're dealing with such an unwieldy power as a 27 member nations in the European Union. Germany is finding a way around all of that, isn't it?
It is. And I think it is. That point about urgency, I think, is a good one, because, you know, Germany doesn't have a government right now. or at least they do. They've got a caretaker government in the form of Angela Merkel while they have all of these coalition negotiations. And typically when you're in that situation and you've got a caretaker government, they don't make big decisions. They typically don't make any decisions. They just do the bare minimum to kind of keep things running over and then hand over to the new coalition. For them to be moving forwards with this during this kind of time period shows a level of urgency, a level of practical urgency. I think it also, they would only be doing this if there was a pretty broad consensus within Germany and within these different German political parties. They probably talked to the future coalition members and gotten their thoughts on this. So it shows that broad consensus. And I think it shows something that we've seen quite a lot from Europe, where France is always the one out in front, dancing around, making the speeches, talking about the need for a European military. All the while, Germany tends to be the one that's quietly making it happen. You know, 2/3 of the Dutch command structure of the Dutch army is in the German army. You've got a Czech and Romanian tank brigade, you know, several thousand soldiers in the process of, or several brigades from them, in the process of integrating their military into the German army. You know, in a lot of ways, we have a kind of small nucleus of a European army. It's the Bundeswehr. It's the German army. So they have, we can't underestimate the practical steps that they've taken already. And it's not led to a functioning European military that has been able to deploy within Afghanistan. But at the same time, we can't underestimate the foundations that have already been laid. And I think with this, we could see some more of those foundations being put in place. And again, Germany doesn't seek the limelight in this. I think you know, they know if the headline is Germany's creating a European military, they would get much more pushback on that. They're quite happy for France to go out and do a lot of the talking and being seen as the leaders. But at the same time, they're very keen to make sure something is happening and have been taking these kind of practical steps.
We do have a trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military, that we'll link to. I'd also encourage you to stay tuned and watch for the cover story of the coming Trumpet edition. We just sent it off to the printer yesterday from Gerald Fleury about how Europe is about to be hijacked. And he talks about this push for a unified military in the wake of America's evacuation from Afghanistan. Thank you, Richard. Donald Trump declared Jerusalem the undivided capital of Israel. The Biden administration wants to redivide it. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is a pretty bold move that the Biden administration is pursuing. Of course, they're not going to come out and say that they are rejecting the idea that there's a United States embassy in Jerusalem, or that Jerusalem isn't the undivided capital of Israel. However, what they're trying to do on the ground is effectively doing just that. We have talked about this before, but it is moving forward. This is the establishment of a separate Palestinian consulate inside Jerusalem, inside West Jerusalem. So this is something that the Biden administration wants to do. This is something that even this left-wing government knows that if it happens, it's probably going to dissolve their government or their coalition. So this week it turned out that Yair Lapid, the foreign minister, or really the strongman behind this government, he met with Antony Blinken, and they're going to establish basically a secretive group that's going to start working on this behind the scenes, and then it's meant to actually come into effect sometime after a budget is passed in the next couple of months. And what it would mean is that there would be a Palestinian consulate or Palestinian mission that operates on Agron Street inside West Jerusalem, really the center of Jerusalem. And it counters, obviously, United States law. United States Embassy Act states that Jerusalem is the undivided capital of Israel. It would be like going to Washington, D.C. and asking, say, Israel goes to Washington, D.C. and puts a consulate to Mexico in Washington, D.C. Obviously, that wouldn't be allowed. Why would you do it there? This is not the capital of that future state. So the Israelis are saying, if you want to do something like this, put it in Ramallah. Put it in an area that's under Palestinian control. Why would you want to put a consulate in the middle of West Jerusalem? This is what the Palestinian prime minister said. He said this move is going to be important because it's a message from the Biden administration that Jerusalem is not one united Israeli city and that the American administration does not recognize the annexation of Arab land by the Israeli side. We want the American consulate to constitute the seed of the U.S. embassy in the state of Palestine. And again, where's the location of this? It's going to go right inside West Jerusalem. And so it's hard to see how this is going to happen without Israeli fighting over this. And it's hard. It's obviously a very unpopular decision if it makes its way to the press inside the United States, since the United States is so pro-Israel. However, it does reveal a lot that the Biden administration is pushing for this establishment of a Palestinian mission inside Jerusalem.
Well, we watch Jerusalem closely, particularly because of prophecies that Jerusalem will be divided. And for the United States, a staunch ally of Israel in the past, to make a move that would hasten the division of Jerusalem certainly brings those prophecies to light. We have an article on the website, "Is the Fall of East Jerusalem Imminent?" We'll link to that in the show notes for the program today. Thank you very much. Brent, one final story. There are a lot of radicals out there using environmentalist rhetoric to push for economic transformation. Among them is the heir to the British throne. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there's a big United Nations climate change summit coming up in Glasgow, Scotland next month. And Prince Charles of Britain is warning that this could be our last chance to save humanity from the threat of climate change. Now, Prince Charles has been a big supporter of combating climate change for years. He was at the 2014 Paris Climate Change Summit, which he also said was our last chance, and the 2009 Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen, Denmark, which he also said was our last chance. So this Glasgow Summit is really like our last chance to save humanity from climate change. So he's putting a bit of pressure on this. So it's in the time we have left, we'll talk about, look, what particularly does he want us to do in order to take advantage of this last chance to save humanity from climate change? And the answer to that is he has two particular projects he's pushing. One is called the Terra Carta, supposed to be like a charter of rights for the planets, which mainly is telling nations and companies that sign up to it that they need to abide by the carbon reduction targets set at the last UN climate change conference, the Paris Climate Change conference, that's saying that we need to reduce our carbon footprint to zero in the next 50 years if we're gonna save the world. One of the articles we can put in the show notes is what the Paris Climate Change Accords were really about, by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, that will talk a little bit more in detail about that particular aspect of what he wants to sign up with. But the second thing, and this is pretty interesting, is a project he's working on called the Great Reset. Now, a lot of our listeners, they've probably heard of the Great Reset. It's the idea that we're going to use this Building Back Better movement after the COVID lockdown to rebuild the world economy on a more socialist way. A lot of conspiracy theorists talk about it, but it was actually this Great Reset product was the cover story of Time magazine. So it's definitely something that world leaders are talking about. And it's kind of like the brainchild of Prince Charles and the leader of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, who's a German's professor. So this isn't just Prince Charles supporting the Great Reset, is that in many ways, along with Pope Francis and Professor Schwab, he kind of invented it and is really using this, that like, hey, if we're going to, we need to use this this opportunity, as he'd phrase it, after the COVID pandemic to save the world from diseases and climate change by basically having companies work together with governments in order to regulate how much carbon you can produce. And since all industry produces carbon, that's basically companies need to team up with the government to regulate all industry on the planet. And so it's you just think about it for a minute, and it's really, really authoritarian. They've actually turned to Pope Francis to give his advice on how to do this, because it's so similar to the ideology called as Catholic corporatism or fascism in the classic sense of the term, not the just using that term as an inset, but like Mussolini said that fascism was the merger of state and corporate power in order to regulate pretty much all aspects of human life. And so some really concerning stuff here with what they're trying to push. And it is interesting that in a large part, it is the Pope and this German engineer that are pushing this fascist economic system. So you've got Germany and the Vatican telling the world that you need to use this threat of climate change to revive the type of economics that Mussolini preached. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the ironic part is like Prince Charles is really signed up whole hog on this to convince the world that this is what we have to do to take advantage of our last chance to save the world from climate change.
Andrew has an article on this subject. Prince Charles supports the Great Reset. It goes into quite a bit more detail about the history of this idea, where it came from, the roots in fascist thinking back some generations, and its place in prophecy as well. So go check that out, and we'll also link to Gerald Fleury's article, What the Paris Climate Agreement Was Really About. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of William James. Human beings, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspects of their lives. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.